tonight the topic is pleasure, which is one of my favorite topics. And I'm hoping it'll be less just a lecture and more of a discussion. So I think whoever's here tonight is going to basically define the area that the conversation goes. I see my job is kind of containing it and guiding it. But I want us to think about what pleasure is and what the search for happiness is. Right? It's in our Declaration of Independence, right? Isn't it the Declaration of Life, Liberty, and the Pursuit of Happiness? So we all technically have been endowed with that right to pursue happiness. How are we doing? You know? I mean, like, how's it going for you? How's it going for us as a culture? And so what does it mean that we have the right to pursue happiness? And is that a real pursuit if we don't have the tools in how to pursue it? So I want us to look at that tonight. And I want us to have some shared language right off the bat. And so I drew this up, which many of you know what this is. Anybody have an idea of what this might be if you don't immediately know? Yeah, nice. Hey, how's it going? You got the sushumna nadi. So this is the subtle inner body, okay? And I'm not here to prove this to you or anything like that. We're not debating that stuff. You just have to suspend disbelief and buy it for the evening, and then you can throw it out. But your body is made up of an intricate, subtle network of channels. Many of us believe in this more than, say, our parents did because of the popularity of things like acupuncture and acupressure, which deal with these nadis, these inner subtle channels in the body. They say there's 64,000 of them, and we're only going to talk about three tonight. And the three important ones are the central channel, the Sushumna Nadi. It's also called the Uma in Tibetan. There's actually a whole bunch of names for it, really beautiful names, but those are the two most common. And this runs basically from the kind of the third eye area, and it runs up the top of the head, and then down a little bit in front of the backbone. Just try to feel where that might be in your body. And then it comes up, and there's a lot of different kind of stuff, but mostly it ends at the tip of the sexual organ. And then on the right-hand side, anybody know the name of the right-hand channel?
Yeah.
Pingala, right? Thank you, Rob. Yeah, so the Ida's left hand, right hand's Pingala, which is... we're dealing with two basic forces, which are aversion and attraction. You hear this in Buddhism sometimes, this notion of aversion and attraction. What are some other names for aversion and attraction? What else?
Liking and disliking,
right? So liking would be under attraction. The reason not positive and negative, because they both can be positive or negative. From an emotional standpoint. What else?
Fear and desire.
Yeah, fear would probably be over here, and desire. The right-hand channel runs parallel to the central channel, the Sushumna, the Pingala, and it crosses over the Sushumna Nadi in a few different places. What places, it depends on what scriptures you're reading. The Tibetans have less than most of the Hindu scriptures. But you can see where it crosses over, right? And we would call this a chakra. Most of us are familiar with chakras. In this kind of system, chakras are not like pretty things. They're, in fact, the places where you're choking your central channel. And because of that choke, prana is leaking out of there. And they kind of petal out. So when you see chakras in like New Age bookstores, they're colorful and they have pretty petals. The reason is that's actually the release of vital energy. So it's actually the thing that kills you is these choke points. So here's the interesting thing, and I don't want to go much into this, but this is the thing that I'm hopefully will be important for our conversation, is when I am... Has anybody had a real strong negative emotion today? I mean, we probably all have, but does anybody have one that they'd want to share that just really stands out? Talk about exposing yourself in front of a group. Yeah.
Well, I just found out that a friend, ex-friend, has cancer.
Uh-huh.
So that has a lot of, all kinds of negative emotions.
Yeah, so which one, which side would that be? The right side here or the left side? It would be fear, disliking, aversion, right? Any other strong emotions come up for people today?
Hurt.
Hurt's an interesting one. Because it gets subtle, but what do you think heartbreak would go under? Yeah, they say, right, the left side. Interesting, right? Attraction, that kind of grasping onto, and that feeling of that ripping away. So here's the thing. Let's say your heart gets broken. Let's say, just to make it dramatic, let's say you walk in on your partner with somebody else. Okay, that's like boom. Now, can you decide in that moment, like say you're familiar with all this stuff, right? And you say, okay, I'm just going to choose to be patient. Can you just choose to be patient and loving? You really can't, right? I mean, you can choose to not react, but you cannot choose to have your mind not be upset. You see what I'm saying? You cannot choose. And sometimes it's like a poison, right? That suddenly, just like that, has entered your body. I speak from experience. You know, it's just like, boom. All of a sudden you have a poison in your body. The same is food poisoning. You just take it, and just in an instant, you're going to be purging for the next 12 hours. You know? And it's just like that. Like, you'll feel better for a moment, and then, oh no, here it comes again, right? And you've all had this with heartbreak. It's like, you feel better, and all of a sudden, oh, I can't believe it. And what's happening is that there's a physical thing that's happening, which I think is so fascinating, right? What's happening is prana, or chi, or it's not the Apaches. One native tribe calls it Arenda. Such a beautiful word. Prana, this energy that moves through your body is moving away from, say, the central channel and going mostly to the left-hand channel. So physically, it's actually harder for you to have a grounded, clear thought. Such an interesting thing, right? We don't normally think of that as a physical thing. And meaning that if I do a twist to the right, what am I doing? I'm stretching that. I mean, technically, I'm stretching that channel, making it physically easier for me to be kind and patient. A very interesting idea that yoga is actually designed to physically align my subtle body so that I can think clearly. And if you read all the original yogic scriptures, that was the intention of yoga. You happen to get a nice butt if you do it every day, but the original intention of yoga is to actually make it possible for you to actually think clearly. Now, what happens when you walk in on your partner in bed with somebody else, right? Your vision goes like this. You know? You have like blinders, like you're unable to see reality clearly. Or even if you're just suspiciously jealous. You know, every little thing like your partner does, you'll be like, what is that supposed to mean? You know? But they say that prana runs into the central part of the central channel, the umma, only a couple times in our life. Now, when prana is in the central channel, we are full of love, full of compassion, open-hearted. Trungpa calls it the spontaneous heart, the totally innocent heart, the totally innocent mind. No preconceived notions, just totally spontaneously flowing. You know, you hear these saints like the hugging saint. What did you say? Amma, yeah, right? And she can spend like 28 hours just hugging people nonstop. Like, for me, like, put yourself in that space, right? I'm like on hug number 28, okay? And I see thousands of people, right? And I'm just thinking like, oh my God, you know, like, when am I going to get a cookie? You know, like, my mind is already going ahead. You know what I mean? Think about it. Your mind is already going to, within a few minutes, I'm going to be anxious, you know, and then within a half hour, I'm going to be in hell. Potentially, right? But if you have a totally spontaneous heart, if you have a heart that totally doesn't have any, what's the word I'm looking for? Not preconceived, but maybe it's preconceived. No There's no like meta thought. It's just spontaneous, right? Then you wouldn't get exhausted by something like that. Every interaction, you'd be meeting it as a fresh interaction. Every person would just be a simple delight. And you wouldn't be looking past them and being like, oh, God. You know? Or like, oh, not the smelly guy. You know? Like, it's just, everything is a delight. So they say when we have prana running through the central channel, that's the kind of person we are. Now, most of us have this happen only a couple times in our life. Interestingly enough, they say at the moment of death. Everything just for a moment. All of these chakras, these choke points, just release. And for a moment, we have energy flood through the central channel. A total releasing, right? Oftentimes, at the moment of death, people defecate themselves, you know? And it's just that kind of relief. And then they also say at the moment of orgasm, just a split second at the moment of orgasm, we have that opening of those of all those choke points. And we have prana just run through that central channel. I've also heard that with... What's that?
That's way more than a couple times in your life.
Yeah, no, no. I mean, I don't mean like... I mean a couple of events, like two different events. Yeah. For most of us, that's more than a couple times. Yeah.
There have to be other ways,
yeah. And there are other ways.
Chocolate
is a profound... But yeah, and a lot of what we're talking about tonight is, in fact, how to move prana out of those side channels and move them into the central channel. And in fact, it's the goal of many spiritual paths is to do that, yeah. Okay, just stretching that. All right, so here's a couple. Those of you that know me and you've come to my talks, you hear the same stuff over and over because you know I'm obsessed with a few things. And the way my mind functions, so you're unfortunately going to be drawn into that, is I think about problems. And then I try to work my way out of the problem. So I want to present a couple problems tonight. In this very room I gave a class, there was a billboard on Broadway. And the billboard showed a woman with a shopping bag, and it said, like, Tucson Mall. Does anybody remember that billboard? And she's, like, ecstatic. She's skipping, and the bag is, like, in midair, and her, like, dress is blowing. And she has almost an orgasmic look of, like bliss, right? And it's, like, to get people to shop at the Tucson Mall. So I came here to this class, and we were making fun of that billboard. I'd never been to the Tucson Mall. I'd lived here for 8 years. I'd never ventured over there. And the very next day, or 2 days later, my girlfriend called me and said, I need you to go to the mall with me. Right? So I'm like, fine. You know, and you know, we really bash this whole notion like shopping doesn't bring happiness and stuff like that. So anyway, went to the mall. We went shoe shopping and I forget, did some other stuff. And we started laughing and kidding around. And when it came time to leave, to go back to the car, we were literally skipping, right, with the bag. And all of a sudden, like, I get a vision of myself. And I'm like, oh, shit, you know? Like, wait a second. I'm not supposed... shopping isn't supposed to bring me happiness, right? Because we've been fed that in the kind of New Age culture that shopping doesn't bring happiness. The chocolate doesn't bring happiness, you know? That all these things we're addicted to don't bring us happiness. But I think we need to make the conversation a little more complex because it does seem to bring us happiness. So there's my dilemma. Dilemma number one, right, is shopping seemed to bring me a lot of happiness. Okay? Now, I'm going to contrast this with the goat story, which many of you know, right? As I was canoeing in the Rio Grande, and me and my buddies, and we heard a goat call, bah! And we're looking around, there's no trees, there's nothing, there's just openness, and we can't see where the call is coming from. And it's about like the distance from me to the bathroom, and we still don't see a goat. It's a very like hallucinatory feeling, you know? And all of a sudden, my buddy sees out of the mud a goat's mouth. And the goat had been sinking for days, you know? So we like very quickly went into action to get the goat out of the mud. You know, we got out of the canoe, we got paddles to dig it out, we got ropes, you know. It just was like a whole ordeal. We eventually, after about 40 minutes, hoisted the goat out, We fed it, we made a mush out of power bars and water, and like, we fed it this mush, and we were with it for a while, and then we ended up having lunch there, and eventually it walked away. It was healthy enough to actually walk away. So that, two extraordinary experiences, or we'll say two pleasurable experiences, right? Shoe shopping and freeing the goat. And there's a clue in here that I haven't quite been able to figure out between the difference between these two kinds of pleasure. Now, here's what happened with the shoe shopping. Is the very next day, I woke up and I had a desire to go back to the mall. I really did. And I did go back to the mall. Like, we found an excuse to go back. And I'm just, the whole time, I'm like, this is just ridiculous, right? I haven't been to the mall in 8 years, and now I have to go twice in 2 days. You know what I mean? Now, the next day after I woke up from freeing the goat, I did not have the feeling like I need to go find more goats. You know, I didn't have, but there was a deep sense of contentment and goodwill. There was a deep feeling of, I had just something in my heart that felt like it had a deep kind of pleasure in it. So, let's define happiness, first of all. And Mateo Ricard, he's an interesting guy. I think he was a physicist, and then he became a Tibetan Buddhist monk. But an interesting man. He says this. He says, by happiness, I mean here the deep sense of flourishing that arises from an exceptionally healthy mind. Right? The deep sense of flourishing that arises from an exceptionally healthy mind. This is not a mere pleasurable feeling, a fleeting emotion, or a mood, but an optimal state of being. So again, if we're talking about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and if we take this definition, we're talking about life, liberty, and the pursuit of a exceptionally healthy mind, optimal mood, a flourishing. And then if we go to the earlier example, we're talking about a heart, a spontaneous heart, right? A heart totally open, totally alive. So, if our problem is just looking at what brings us pleasure, you know, I am innately a lazy person that wants to achieve as much pleasure as possible with the least amount of effort. Like, if I honestly look at my situation, that's what I want. I want as much pleasure for myself, and I want to get it at the least amount of effort possible. So is that contradictory to the spiritual life?
I don't think so.
What'd you say?
I don't think so.
You don't think so. Why do you think it's not contradictory? It seems contradictory, doesn't it? What would make me different? What if
I guess, yeah.
Yeah.
Before, I would say I had any kind of sort of realization, I probably thought that way. There was a sense of austerity being associated with that spiritual life.
Yeah.
But then I've had experience. Well, when you realize that sort of like you're not your spirit, in that these austerities are only related to your limitations as a body or as a physical body. It doesn't make sense that you would have to do them, you know. In other words, you are beyond the body, so there must be some effortless way of not of experiencing this bliss, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, and austerity is an interesting point, right? Because oftentimes you see, and I've lived in monasteries, and you see this particularly with new monks that just come into the monastery. Mm-hmm. There's a sense that a spiritual life means a somber life. And there's a thing like, you know, you talk a little bit quieter, and you're like, I'm now a monk. And, you know, I've now entered the spiritual life, and, you know, I'm not going to look at any women with lust. And, you know, it has a kind of slight feeling of disembodiment. But then when you see the older monks, the ones that are really doing it right, they're so robust. They're so full of life. You know, some of the conversations I had with some of the older monks in the monastery, like, you would be shocked, right? It sounds like a bunch of guys in a bar room, you know? And one of my jobs in the monastery was to, this is a Trappist monastery I lived in, was to rub huge blocks of cheese to stimulate the growth, right? Because it's a living enzyme cheese. So there I am in these underground cellars rubbing cheese with all of these celibate monks, you know? And it's just like, it's the same, it's like barroom conversation. It's the same thing you would imagine if a group of guys were having to rub cheese together, you know? It's like all the kind of innuendos come up, and it's robust, it's funny, you know? And these are deep, deep spiritual beings. So you see with this thing of austerity, right? It's not about diminishing something, but learning a new way to inhabit your full humanness. Now something comes up for me when I think about this, and I was teaching on a similar topic in Detroit recently, and a woman said, "Well, what's the difference between renouncing and resisting?" Right? Because if I'm somebody who's just entered the spiritual life, oftentimes I'm working on resisting stuff, right? Like, what would be an example of somebody on the spiritual life trying to resist something? Alcohol. Or not even on the spiritual life, in our very own life. So we try to resist, great example, we try to resist alcohol. For me, sugar is a big one. But so what's the difference between resisting alcohol and renouncing alcohol?
Renouncing is more of a neutral position. I'm not attracted to it, and I'm not repulsed by it either. I'll take it or leave it.
Uh-huh.
Whichever way it goes for the moment.
But now, what if you had an addiction to alcohol?
Uh-huh.
It's hard to be neutral, right?
At times.
When you renounce something, you make an agreement with yourself that you don't need it.
Yeah.
Whereas with resisting, you're arguing with yourself that you do need it, but you don't want it, or you choose not to participate in it even though you want it.
Yeah, right. And anybody else have any ideas on that? Any thoughts of difference between renouncing and resisting? Yeah.
Well, it's like a sacrifice. So maybe it's something that you enjoy. And you either, like, maybe enjoy it or
it seems to me that resisting, you're in an active state of pushing away.
Yeah.
So you assume that the object has force against you, maybe, but when you renounce it, I'm lost.
No, it's nice, because what you're saying is you're in an active state of resisting, right?
Right.
And here's my whole thing with willpower on the spiritual life. I've personally found it totally doesn't work. Right? Because here's what happens with willpower, which I observed one night in my kitchen. All right, there's a big chocolate cake in the fridge, right? I'm like, I've already decided I'm not going to have any more, like, cake tonight because I'm sugared out. So I'm resisting. I really, really want the cake, okay? So I'm resisting it. What's that happening inside my body? First of all, where's the prana going? Right, it's going to the left side, right?
So it's scattering your mind.
Because it's craving, right?
Okay. I don't
yeah.
know.
Yeah, maybe. But what were you saying, Brooke?
Oh, it just seems like resisting is an amplifier.
Yeah, nice. And what
happens is, like, broadcasts it louder and louder and louder.
Yeah, because what happens in my mind, right? My mind is getting more and more fragmented. I'm a visual person, so I tend to think in images. What's happening is, like, my mind is getting more and more fixated on the chocolate cake, right? When I wasn't feeling a strong desire for the chocolate cake, I could be spontaneous, right? I could talk to somebody. I could talk to James, and my mind wouldn't be going like, I wonder how good the cake is. You know? I could just simply talk to James. But as the craving becomes stronger, as I'm using willpower to resist it more and more, I'm having my vision is going like this, and I'm barely even seeing James. I'm just thinking about the cake. So what happened for me that night was I'm thinking like, all right, you know, and I got to a point where I said, you know what? I'm going to just eat the cake, because then it will be gone and I'll be relieved from this anxiety and resistance. Like, you know, and to me in that moment, that sounded like a totally rational, logical thought, you know? And then as soon as I finished it and I felt bad, I was like, oh my God, that was the most irrational, you know, it was like ridiculous. So when you're resisting, there's a tension. And as you resist more and more, that tension gets greater and greater. So eventually the internal system will falter to in a sense, the greater the tension, the greater the pleasure at the release of that tension. What is foreplay? It's creating a tension in the body so that the sexual experience is a better one. I mean, when you think about it, and we're just having foreplay with all the things that are bringing us suffering. We can call it suffering foreplay. That's what we do day in and day out, right? We're like, we're just creating a tension. We're creating a kind of, like a pressure. And so then when the willpower fails, we'll have a seemingly increased pleasure. And I haven't quite, it seems right that it's a seemingly. Because if it was a real increased pleasure, we wouldn't wake up the next morning wanting chocolate cake again. I'm suspecting, right? So here's my theory called the wisdom gap. On the top you have tequila and feeling bad. And on the bottom you have vodka and feeling bad. Okay? Now the very first drink I grew up on as a young child was vodka. Right? So when I think of vodka, I just automatically equate it with feeling bad. Right? So do I need willpower to resist vodka? Right? Because there's an immediate sense of what the vodka does to me. Now, tequila, I've only had wonderful experiences with tequila. Like, I seem to be blessed. Like, I don't drink anymore, but I used to, and I just never had a problem with tequila. Right? And so, I knew that excessive tequila drinking would cause me problems, would create bad feelings, you know? But it was an intellectual feeling. It wasn't embodied, right? I'm on this big kick of embodiment after listening to, of all things, the vagina monologues. Eve, what's her name?
Ensler.
Eve Ensler. She's just a fantastic woman. I heard a talk that she gave on how she came about her life's work. But so here is a wisdom that's embodied, meaning that there's no longer a need for willpower. And here there's still a need for willpower. Now, to use the example of drinking, eventually, if we have an issue, if we have an addiction to drinking, what happens is eventually it has to, this has to get smaller and smaller, right? And usually the way that it does that is our life starts falling apart, right? Everything starts falling apart, and we have the wisdom to equate the falling apart with the addictive behavior. So slowly, when you see alcohol, you again, this is if you have an addiction to alcohol, you fill in the blank with whatever you might be addicted to. So the minute you see alcohol, as that wisdom gap gets shorter and shorter, you automatically bring to mind the feeling of a life out of control, life out of balance, unpleasantness, unhappiness, right? So how can we shorten the gap? And what do we need to shorten the gap to? Right? What is it? What is the replace tequila and vodka? What are the things that are causing us suffering? I think this is the ultimate proof on why willpower doesn't work. You've never met somebody that's been on the South Beach diet for like 10 years. You know what I mean? I met a woman that was she was on the South Beach diet, and I'm like, how long are you going to do it for? And she said, I finally made up my mind, this is it. I'm just going to do it for the rest of my life. And, you know, the minute I heard that, I'm like, oh, no, you know? And sure enough, it was about 3 weeks. And I said, what happened to the South Beach diet? She's like, you know, I realized it just wasn't for me. You know? And so willpower will always fail, right? So if we look at normal roads to pleasure breed suffering. Normal roads to pleasure breed suffering. What does that mean? What could that mean?
Sense gratification is often what we're told will bring us happiness.
Sense gratification, yeah. Yeah, what were you going to say, Sean?
I was just going to say that, you know, the normal road to seeking pleasure is without consciousness, without, like,
Yeah, right.
And you don't need to think about the repercussions.
Yeah, and that's, to me, that there's a clue in there, because the cake does bring us a momentary happiness, a momentary pleasure. The shoe shopping does bring us a momentary pleasure. But what we don't oftentimes see is all the gremlins that are attached onto that. Here's an example. I was in class one night, and all of a sudden, some cookies started getting passed around. It was a large class. There was about maybe 150 people in there. And I'm looking at the basket of cookies, and I realize that there's about 50 of them. Okay? So again, I was able to catch my mind. And I think I was only able to catch my mind just because I have a daily meditation practice. If I didn't have that, this whole thing would have gone unconscious. But here's what my mind did. My mind just fixated on the cookies, right? And I did a quick mathematical equation. Okay. Cookies are coming in that door. I'm sitting over in this part of the room. Roughly 50, 55 cookies in the basket. About 80 people between me and the cookies, right? So as the cookies get passed around, I'm getting more and more anxious. To the absurd level that I'm actually having negative thoughts about people that I normally would care about. Right? Like, I'm actually thinking, like, a guy reaches for a cookie, I'm like, yeah, that guy needs a cookie. This is a guy that I love, right? He's a guy under a normal circumstance, I would, like, bake him a cookie. But because I'm having grasping, right? I'm having sudden surge of prana into the left-hand channel. Right? I'm unable physically to care for the guy that just took the cookie. You see, it's so interesting. I'm physically unable to actually have that experience. So then my mind's like, all right, well, now it's getting drastic. And I might have to employ drastic means. So I'm thinking about getting up in the middle of class and walking over and securing a cookie for myself, right? And then just as, I swear this is true, just as I'm having that thought, the guy next to me does it. So he gets up and he gets two cookies and comes back, right? And now I'm like, oh, I gotta act now, you know? I gotta do something. So eventually what happens, right, is I don't do it and I'm just mad and I'm frustrated and I'm anxious. Again, I'm not talking about overtly. Right? I'm talking about very subtle. That if I wasn't aware of what was going on, I wouldn't have even noticed it. Right? I would have thought I was listening to the class, but I would have really been not very present. You know how when a friend says, you're not even listening to me. You say, yes, I am. You just said this, this, and this. You're like, yeah, you can repeat it, but you're not listening. Right? So in a sense, I was listening to the class like that, because what was really going on was anxiety. So what ended up happening was another basket of cookies came in. And it ended up being like 300 cookies. And I had like four, and then I was like totally satiated. And then they're like, do you want any more? I'm like, no. Right? So if I wasn't aware of what happened, I would just say that the cookies brought me pleasure. Right? If I was unaware of what had just happened, I would say the cookies brought me pleasure. But now, because I was able to watch my mind, what actually happened? The cookies brought me anger. They brought me anxiety. They brought me ill feelings about people I care about. You know, it's such an interesting mix of stuff. So, and most of the things that I think are bringing me pleasure have this same, like, grouping of gremlins attached onto them. Okay, so if we buy that, right? If we buy that that's true, what do we do? I mean, because it, like, still, you're talking about, like, okay, does that mean I have to increase willpower? Like, how the hell, then, when a cookie comes into the room, do I not crave it? And is the cookie, in and of itself, the bad thing? Right? Is the sex, in and of itself, the bad thing? Is the alcohol, in and of itself, the bad thing? What do you think?
You put the qualities of whatever that has onto it.
Yeah, I mean, I put the qualities onto it because some other people, like the woman next to me, didn't even notice the cookies come in, which blows my mind. Because right? later I'm talking to her about this. She's like, oh, I didn't even see them come in. I said, you must have seen the commotion. And the guy next to us got up, and she's like, no, I didn't even notice that, right? So my mind has what we'd say like a bok chak, like a seed for sugar. Like it just, when I see sugar, I'm like, zing, I heard a story recently of a town dog. I forget where it was. Some of you may have heard this story. That it just was like owned by the town, you know? And it was some little town, I think, in Northern California. And every time like a red car drove by, it would get up and wag its tail. And the thought was that its owner had a red car at one time. Nobody knew where the dog came from or who owned it. It just showed up one day. So that dog had what we'd say a bok chak, a seed for red cars. You know, when it saw a red car, something triggered inside of it, something like a hope of its owner or something. So I have these seeds for sugar, right? We all have these seeds for stuff that are going to trigger us to do this. So if my goal is to achieve pleasure, if my goal is to achieve happiness, and I buy into this whole wisdom gap and the three channels and stuff, then how am I going to go about achieving as much pleasure as possible for myself?
Moderation.
I don't have an answer for you, by the way. I mean, I'm stuck. I'm hoping you guys will work it out for me.
That's what we came for.
Yeah, you know, I secretly call it class, but really it's like therapy. All right, so moderation. What else?
Maybe it's the awareness that you talked about, the ability to separate, create space between the feeling of pleasure and what you experience in between.
Yeah, nice. What were you going to say, Brooke?
I don't know if this, my mind is kind of... But what I think of is, I connect it with relationship and your discussion of resistance and like the question that forms from that one for me. So I was actually throwing out this question.
Yeah, good.
Is that like the push-pull dynamic that happens in a relationship when it's one person owns grasping,
yeah,
and if the other person owns resisting,
yeah,
also that the universe is complete between them.
Yeah.
Like really, like the universe is trying to in some way, both people are playing a role, but it's as if the dynamic of intimacy is propelled by that resistance.
Yeah.
So each person is like agreeing to a part of that contract, and so I guess my question is then, what is the secret of an intimacy that is not at all based on that resistance? And so like, you know,
yeah,
like people can take vows to you.
Yeah, right.
But still have a total alive dynamic. Like the liveliness of the dynamic doesn't depend upon the resistance that's played between the two people. And I guess that's...
Yeah, to me that's one of the most fascinating questions. And here's how I form it in my mind. Is, let's say that... let's pose this particular possibility. We all strive, let's move away from alcohol for a minute and go to sex, right? We all strive to have the greatest sex possible. I mean, I think that's true, but because you don't really have the experience of like, you're about to have sex with your partner, and you're like, honey, let's just keep it mediocre, right? It's not like, let's just keep it mellow and mediocre, and let's just kind of get it over with. So it's not too pleasurable. Right? I mean, everybody strives to have great sex. Now, here's the interesting thing, is I think that the greatness of the sex correlates with the pain of the end of the relationship. Okay, do you follow me? That the greater the sex you had in the relationship, the more painful it is when that relationship ends.
Why?
Well, I mean, I think one reason is because you just missed the great sex, right? And I realized this. I worked for a long time, not for a long time, it felt like a long time. I worked for 4 months totally alone on a farm with this farmer that just, when I showed up on the farm, he made me do everything and just wallowed away in dark rooms. But so I was alone all the time, and I was just thinking all the time, like just about my life. And all of a sudden it occurred to me that I lived my whole life solely based on how well it would relive as a memory. See, madness, right? I was living my life based on how well it would relive as a memory. Yeah, and you see people do this all the time, right? I mean, Disneyland, it's like, okay, smile for the camera, make it look like we're having fun, you know? It's like, and holidays are classic, right? Like, holidays are, for many people, are a total nightmare. And it's, you know, under the under the false pretense of let's all get together and have a great time. Right? So, I have no idea why I brought that up in relation to your question, but I'm sure it'll come back to me in a minute. So, Shad's question was, why do you think that great sex would correlate with increased pain at the end of a relationship? What do you think?
Because